they never cop nothing. I keep you in, girl, with his
toes and your toes. This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, Healthful Living's radio show. We come to you every Thursday at noon, and we are here today. I am Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and as many of you that have listened before know, we talk about issues of not only our personal health, but the health of the planet and our community. And today we are going to have an incredible guest on talking about the environment and in terms of petroleum and peak oil and all of that. So let me see if I can get him on the line. We are going to have Jan Lundberg on, and he is the president, the director of culturechange.org and an expert in the field of peak oil, and he's going to be talking to us today about the Petro Collapse conference that he was just at. Jan, are you there?
Yes, Julie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, just great over here in the Big Apple.
All right. So I hear you have been at the Petro Collapse conference.
Yes. We organized that successfully. It took place at the Unitarian Church in Manhattan on October 5th all day.
Oh, wow. And you had quite a lineup of speakers, it looked like.
Yes. We were fortunate to have folks like James Howard Kunstler, the author of The Long Emergency, Mike Rupert, author of Crossing the Rubicon, and we had a couple of scientists, one named David Pimentel from Cornell University, and the other from Congressman Roscoe Bartlett's office, and his name is John Darnell.
Hmm.
And we had some other speakers, David Room of Post Carbon Institute, Jason Meggs of the Plan B Project, and both of them are over on the East Bay. And we also had Pincus Jawetz, Michael Caine, Aaron Nempersteck, Albert Bates. Gosh, I hope I'm not forgetting anybody. Well, Jenna Orkin, our able moderator. We had Dan Miner. And myself.
Hmm. And do you have any picketers out front?
No, the conference was, you could almost say, boycotted by the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have the Pacifica station WBAI there, and they had helped promote the conference in a couple of interviews in prior days. And there were independent film video documentary makers there, one of them named Greg Green, who put together The End of Suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of that one.
Yes, definitely. So maybe we should start from the beginning. Out of these speakers, did you have... it sounded like you had a moderator, so did you have any sort of panel? Did you have people from kind of... You know, the question that always comes up, or the concern whenever we do a show like this, is does the other side, do the naysayers or the people that don't agree with this, you know, what do they have to say about all this? So I'm curious if any of them were there.
Well, they were among the speakers, because we don't all agree exactly on
mm-hmm.
things. One of the things that people don't agree on is when peak oil is hitting, or when petro collapse will hit.
Hmm.
The other thing that people don't agree on is how much of a role technology and the whole existing economic system will be able to pull through it all, survive intact, perhaps, or complete destruction. And what kind of a post petro collapse world will have? Is it going to be using some fossil fuels, some nuclear energy? Will some cars be fueled? If so, how? So there are differences among people who understand peak oil. I maintain that a full understanding of peak oil requires knowing that the market is a very dangerous system that will exacerbate shortage greatly. There will be price skyrocketing, hoarding of product, and this will create a virtual complete shortage.
Hmm.
So the idea of peak oil being some kind of a gradual downward trend of global oil extraction to mirror the rise and rise of oil extraction over the years to get us to the point we're at now, which is approximately the peak. So it's really just an assumption that the peak of oil production is going to be followed by a gradual lessening of the production of oil.
Now, I can certainly understand what you're talking about, because we've seen this with lots of things before, that when there's a scarcity or something happens that everybody rushes out, everybody wants to buy it, there's, you know, huge lines and the price goes up. But often that kind of levels out, or that big crisis that is originally created kind of peters out over time, and it kind of goes back to, it might still be going in the wrong direction, but the crash resurfaces. I mean, it happens from everything from the stock market to oil in the 70s. So I'd love to hear your perspective of how you feel that this market is going to actually be affected by this change.
I just did this interview with the New York Press moments ago on the same subject, having to do more with transportation issues. Well, the market that basically allowed the kind of shortages we saw in the 1970s was on the context of rising global oil production in those days. But there are some things that we learned from that, and my firm at the time, Lundberg Survey, predicted the second oil shock right on the nose, and that was based on our calculating a 9% shortfall in gasoline deliveries for March of 1979. See, what happens is, in addition to the market getting wind of a gap between supply and demand, not only are prices run up through the roof, but you have a transfer of storage from the usable quantity of fuels at the wholesalers and at the refiners. This transfers to end-users' tanks, which they top off. And picture all the gasoline tanks and cars being topped off, because that's what people do. They don't know if there will be fuel tomorrow, or they don't want to pay more tomorrow than they have to today, so they tend to top off. This massive transfer of storage puts the fuel out of circulation, so the market can no longer provide. Think of the banks. They don't have all the deposits on hand right now if you all go to get them. So that's what we're going to see with the kind of final energy shortage. The reason it will be cataclysmic and terminal is that when we have the prices going way up and we have the market creating a virtually complete shortage, there will be repercussions immediately, because people will not be able to get to work. Trucks will not be able to deliver goods. There will not be food at supermarkets if we don't have the constant flow of oil at affordable prices. So when this starts to gather steam in only a few days' time, there will be instant repercussions. And when the economy is not functioning with the employers and the deliveries and the manufacturing. And remember that a lot of manufacturing and commerce is done by the principle of just-in-time delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So things have gotten a lot faster and complex and interdependent since the 1970s. So there's a cost to pay from all this growth and speed. The system only understands expansion. There is nothing built in or prepared for some kind of a contracted or leveled off gradations of lesser consumption.
And is this, and then of course, I'm assuming that with this chaos, then the rest of the stock market will be affected, and then just even from a psychological perspective, not an, you know, both an economic and a psychological perspective, it will kind of, I'm guessing, spiral everything from there.
Well, we have a general house of cards, but the financial markets are particularly based on a house of cards. So you could have actually a stock market crash triggering problems with, you know, energy deliveries, and instead of a vast price increase reflecting some shortage and creating a much bigger shortage, it's possible that with the kind of disruption to the economy that can come from stock market crash and other effects, including tighter and tighter supplies of petroleum, we may actually experience a collapse of demand, because if you can't keep the cart rolling along with all the increasing fuel consumption and consumption of all these products that are tied to energy use and petroleum substances, there could be a collapse of demand, and people are no longer engaging in the kind of energy use that they were. And this tends to bring about the same effect as if, you know, there was a revolution in Saudi Arabia tomorrow and all production stopped and exports stopped.
So you're saying it could go either way. It could be the oil that creates the economic collapse, or the economic crash creating the oil challenges.
It is all together. We cannot separate out the huge role energy has in our lives and in our society.
Maybe you can just, we can start at the beginning a little bit, or go back to the beginning and talk about what are, for people that really aren't familiar, since it's so ingrained in everything that we do, maybe you can explain a little bit about all of these uses of oil, how our pretty much whole society is ingrained in this need for oil.
Yes. Well, we can go back over 100 years ago when the prime uses of oil refining were kerosene, and then the cars were working with gasoline, jacking up demand there. And what the oil industry was faced with is what to do with all these other products or sludge or toxic waste. The bicyclists got together and demanded paved roads. So there's a use. Asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we saw other uses for oil. There was heating oil, both in distillate and heavy forms, the dregs of oil refining. Plastics were developed, pesticides, dyes, and from natural gas, fertilizers and plastics. And so we've had generally a complete petroleumization, if that's a word, of the economy. It made a difference in World War I, getting away from coal and utilizing the much more versatile and flexible fuels from petroleum. So here today, we have maximum petroleum exploitation and dependence, which is, of course, transportation, food supply, and many materials that we take for granted. People don't even know that plastics are from petroleum,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes.
Right. So are the majority of the people that were at this conference, are they feeling that there's going to be this sudden day where there is no oil, or is it more that we won't be able to afford to buy the oil?
Well, in my speech to the Petrocollapse conference on petrocollapse.org and culturechange.org, if people want to see that. I started out acknowledging that this audience was mostly well-versed in peak oil. With a name like Petrocollapse Conference, I think a lot of people were open to the idea that there's something more than just higher energy prices lately and the damage to the environment from petroleum, such as oil company weather, when you have more intense hurricanes from global warming.
Speaking of the hurricane, maybe I'll deviate a little bit, but this has been a question. I just saw in the news the other day that they said that this winter there's going to be a huge increase in the cost of energy, and of course they're blaming it on the hurricane, and I was curious, is the hurricane an acceptable excuse or reason for this? Or
it should be really a matter of petroleum dependence, because when you have petroleum dependence contributing so much to climate change and more intense hurricanes, there's some background that we don't hear much about, but New Orleans is, you know, a victim of petroleum from the standpoint of all those refineries around that were damaged and leaked, factories that had petrochemicals that leaked, and the end users had, you know, containers of pesticides and other petroleum products, the cars. The floods and the winds did so much damage that the whole place is a toxic Superfund site.
Mm.
But the government, of course, catering to business interests, wants to open up right away for resumed commerce. And this is what happened with the destruction of the Twin Towers. The 9/11 disaster was environmental to a great extent, but the government wanted people to come right back and go to work, and so they lied and said it was safe. But there was, you know, asbestos and other toxic chemicals all over the place that went off the charts in terms of safety levels, and people should not have been there. And so they're being welcomed back into New Orleans as a desperate attempt to put the economy in front of public health.
Mm.
But the other aspect is with the destruction of oil and gas infrastructure from Hurricane Katrina and Rita, we have the problem of just trying to repair all those facilities again and seeing them put back online so that they can cause more destruction. And nothing was learned about our oil dependency.
Right.
So it's a mistake to try to bring everything back and to just to maintain this hopeless system of relying on a finite resource that is going to let us down in the very near future. It already has been letting us down.
In what respect? And are we seeing that, or is it being hidden?
Well, we are seeing it. Not only do we have higher energy prices that we can see with the market price, but there are such subsidies, hidden and direct, for energy that we don't even know what we're paying, but it's a lot more than the official price. So when this gets into the household, when the economy is burdened by these high energy prices, people don't know what they're paying, but they are paying more for food, they're paying more for all these goods and services that have the energy component. So it's no wonder that people are having to work two and three jobs to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the public health impact and the climate change impact. So this whole petroleum disaster is hardly recognized officially or by a woefully unaware public as having already hit. And you can't slow it down. You can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
We're too far out on the limb, and the limb is just about sawed off on the wrong direction of our fat behinds.
What are the different views that were shared at the conference about when this might happen and what this crash, I'm assuming it's mostly economic that we're dealing with, that you're talking about. When is this, what are the different views of when this is supposed to come about and what it might look like? I know you said that it's already kind of started, but, you know, since most people aren't feeling it, is there going to be a day when all this can't be absorbed anymore?
I think most of the people at the conference agree that major changes are afoot. Mike Rupert was claiming that there would be a very rapid deterioration of the economy, and there would be tight supplies, basically causing the full petro collapse experience this winter. He also claimed that the U.S. government was very well aware of peak oil and wanted to see demand destruction so that the properties could be seized and that the population could be enslaved. So there's that view, and there's a more sardonic view of the amusing and oblivious suburban lifestyle that James Howard Kunstler referred to, the easy motoring culture that people have come to expect, and how people in this generation, in this country, have come to expect something for nothing, a magical gift from technology or from the government to allow consumption to constantly rise. So he was quite amusing and was very biting in his humor.
Any other perspectives other than just this winter? Is there?
There are folks who believe that there will be reforms in transportation and electric energy production, so as to enable some semblance of continuity of the consumer economy. And I disagree with that, but we do have to recognize that people will be clinging to technology, and there will be substitution of petroleum made on a spot basis here and there. And some alternatives are going to be more feasible than others, depending on the locale and the kinds of resources available. But you can't plant the whole landscape of this country with a corn to make ethanol. And even if we did, it would be an even energy exchange, or possibly negative. And that's what Dr. Pimentel was demonstrating. It's important for people to look at the energy production ratio. If there's a certain amount of energy required to produce a certain amount of energy, it must not be negative. There was such a fabulous return on energy invested with oil that it was once 100 to 1. But other fuels and technologies have a much less return on energy invested. So that's something to take into account. You can't just say, oh, energy is energy, and hydrogen is energy, and there's unlimited hydrogen, so they will think of something. They will have an answer to energy shortage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work that way.
And so, in other words, people are always talking about, oh, well, we'll just go to nuclear energy. We'll just go to blah, blah, blah. There's plenty of oil in the tar flats or whatever they are in Canada. But what you're saying is that it takes, in some cases, more energy to get those out than you get from them, or it costs so much to take them out that it's not worth getting them out.
That's partly it. And also, you have to look at the possible uses of these forms of energy. Now, that very, very heavy oil that can be derived from the tar sands or from heavy oil deposits in Venezuela or from oil shale in the Rockies, this is not the light, sweet crude that today's oil market wants. so that you get a lot of gasoline out of light crude. But these other products, you can't just run an economy on asphalt and heavy oil.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at other technologies that aren't oil, it's important to recognize that nuclear power will not give you agricultural products. There's no petrochemicals to come from there. There's no asphalt. There's no plastics. Mm-hmm. So kind of a transportation system can be run on alternatives to petroleum? Well, it would be a totally electrified car fleet, but that's not really feasible. It would take years and years to translate this into a new fleet of cars, and the lead time has been lost. It's too late for that because peak oil is hitting too fast.
Mm-hmm. If some people have known for decades or suspected for decades that this was going to hit, why wasn't something done about it? Why isn't the government wanting to admit it? Why couldn't they have admitted it a long time ago and done something about it? Or, you know, what? I guess it's really hard to understand, and this is probably part of the reason that people have such a hard time believing all of this, is why didn't we do something about it or why aren't we even admitting it now?
Well, if Jimmy Carter had been heated with his moral equivalent of war regarding the need for energy conservation and alternatives to oil, then we'd be in a different situation by now. There would probably be renewed rail transit. There would be an end to road building. There would be a lot of conservation in many sectors and parts of the economy, and perhaps a corporate average fuel economy would have been increased instead of decreased, and you wouldn't have the SUV phenomenon today. All this is water under the bridge. So with that poor planning that happened the day that Carter was defeated by the pro-oil Reagan and Bush people, who immediately took the solar panels down from the White House when Reagan was installed, we've come, you know, these and those 2.5 decades to a point of hopeless dependence on petroleum, maximizing the extraction and implementation throughout the economy. So why it didn't happen is sort of secondary to looking at the reality of where we're at today, which is this terrible dependency.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess
some people did know about it, but the government, like industry, is completely short-term oriented with that quarterly profit as the obsession. If that is ignored, then heads roll.
Right.
That, you know, management has to change. Stock market goes down. Or rather, the stock value goes down for any company that's too forward-thinking.
I wanted to go back to something you said, which I had no idea. Did you say that the White House, that Carter put solar panels on the White House?
They were there, but Reagan took them down immediately.
Huh. That's fascinating. Did you ever hear why they were put up and why they were taken down?
Well, Jimmy Carter was very interested alternative energies and conservation. There started to be tax credits, rebates, and almost a flowering of solar energy, both passive and active, in the 1970s. I suppose you could say that oil people don't like the idea of diversity and of diversifying their businesses. In the 1970s, some oil companies were buying other companies. For a while, there was Arco Solar. That was sold off eventually. So we have today the continued dominance of the oil companies, and the whole strategy there is to maximize the demand pie, because a huge volume, an endless volume, they don't have to worry about competition. Not only and everyone in the oil fraternity continue to show up at the petroleum club saying they made record profits because the demand pie is ever growing, but the alternatives are kept out. And it's been the strategy of the oil companies, and especially the OPEC countries, to keep the price of oil at a point where it would be cheaper than alternatives. And what's happened now is that since it's too late for those alternatives really to come on, all pretense has been lost, and the maximum profiteering from oil is going on, and the price will get higher.
Mm.
So people are only thinking short term. That's what kind of leadership we have, and that's why people have to think for themselves and take action.
Sure. That actually makes a lot of sense, and that really helps to illuminate some of the things that because it doesn't make logical sense unless you take some of these points like the short-term profits into consideration. Then it really, unfortunately, does explain a lot of what's going on and what's happened up to this point.
We're all caught up in it.
Yeah.
Personally, we have to worry about paying the rent and being able to get to work and provide for our children and all of these things. But if we continue to completely sacrifice the future for the short-term benefit or short-term survival, then we will have no future.
Mm-hmm.
So what some people are doing today is trying to live that petroleum-free future now. And so they don't have cars. They're minimizing energy consumption. They're getting together and sharing appliances. They're trying to live communally. They're trying to support family in terms of actually actively helping people instead of handing over dollars. So there's much we can do as a movement. I don't know what you'd call it, the sustainable living movement, so that people can band together, help each other, learn how to live cooperatively, engage in mutual aid, and basically achieve a virtual territory of an opposition to the dominant regime,
mm-hmm.
that really is the head of a dying culture.
Right. Well, I just heard of, I don't have a TV, but I saw an interview with Woody Harrelson on talking about the community. He lives in Hawaii, which has no power lines at all. They use solar and wind power and grow their own organic food. And it just sounded like such a wonderful place to live. It was very inspiring.
Well, it is nice to think of a place where you don't have to use fossil fuels for heat and all that. But Hawaii is a place that has 3 days food supply.
Sure.
It is overpopulated. They're hooked into the petroleum economy. So there will be a tremendous shakeout in terms of population there, as there will in every petroleum-dependent society.
Right. Well, let's talk about that, though. If there are these communities, you said that in the 70s, a 9% reduction in the supply caused this big upheaval that we had. And I know that it's a lot worse now because we have long-term diminishing supply. But is there something to that, you know, if there are a percentage of people that start to live this way, will that have any positive effect? I mean, what you were talking about, what some things people can do. So are there things we can do, and how would that possibly benefit or affect us?
Well, we're going to pull through the petro-collapse crisis by helping one another and pooling our knowledge, and not through hoarding some products and fuel and waiting for everything to return to normal, because normal might not come back. So what people are doing today is getting together to share costs and to buy organic foods in bulk. They're trying to minimize their packaging. People are trying to enlighten their friends and family and the general public about the way the government works and the energy crisis. So with all these good efforts, including some permaculture gardens and farming and the idea of people working in a non-hierarchical way to share their skills and run their own lives instead of just reporting to a job and being wage slaves, this really can amount to a lot, especially if more people gravitate to that as a way of surviving. Because when the economy is letting people down, people are being thrown out of work, when they can't afford energy, there needs to be some kind of safe haven. And people aren't going to find that waiting for them when the crisis accelerates, so that there will be a period of chaos. But whatever lasts is going to be upholding a tradition of models of sustainability, whatever those methods are. And that includes composting, gray water systems, keeping bees, processing food to dry it or to make wine, to preserve, canning. These things are going to be necessary, along with depaving of driveways and parking lots to grow food and turning lawns into gardens.
Mm-hmm. So that we can grow some of that food that we can now not ship across the country, it sounds like.
Exactly. So what I think is going to happen this winter, when we still have not had the damage from the oil and gas facilities repaired, taking out a greater than 9% capacity of the oil industry, we're going to see weather play a role in people having a shortage of natural gas for heating and of heating oil. Diesel and heating oil number two are virtually identical. So there will be shortages. What happened with the hurricanes is they hit really after the summer driving season and before the high winter demand period. Globally, winter is the highest period of oil demand. So we're in an in-between period here, and we did see the statement by the Secretary of Energy for the U.S. a couple of weeks ago saying that there will be shortages and higher prices, mm-hmm. and that there will have to be rationing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just not there yet. The effects will be felt, and we're sort of in a calm, before the storm.
Sure. What other? I know that sometimes this issue seems so big that people just tend to not be able to believe that it's happening. What are some of the what are some of the pieces of evidence that you can point to help people understand? Because so many times I hear people say, "Well, I just don't believe it. I don't agree with it. It's not going to happen. It can't happen. We have plenty." Can you go through? I was looking at the, I think it was, I want to say peakoil.org, but I don't remember exactly, where they were talking about some of the stories, different reserves in Saudi Arabia that are declining. Can you just explain a few of those things to people so they can really have a sense of what's really happening, what they might not have heard before?
Well, probably the biggest development is that it seems that Saudi Arabia has peaked in oil extraction. They're desperately trying to get more from the wells, the water injection and other methods. And a maturing oil field is something that causes great concern when it's the real workhorse for the oil market globally. So that's an indication that we may be near a peak. But almost 20 oil-exporting countries or former oil-exporting countries have passed their peak and have had declining oil extraction. Another statistic is that for every barrel of oil discovered today, we're consuming 4 barrels of oil.
Mm.
So this is something that reflects a long-term trend. Oil discoveries peaked globally in the 1960s, and there may be a 40-year lag between peak, and you can see that with the U.S., where oil discoveries peaked in the 1930s, and global peak, U.S. peak oil extraction happened in 1970.
Hmm.
So these various indications, including the fact that more and more energy is required to pump out the oil, and when you look at natural gas being in decline in North America, we've got a hopeless supply-side non-solution to an economy that is completely dependent on petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were saying earlier, these other forms of energy do not replace petroleum. Coal, there's a lot of coal, you say, but how come they're knocking whole mountaintops off in Tennessee to get at some of the remaining desirable coal? So we're going to see more and more desperation to come up with this energy, and it's going to come up way short.
Mm-hmm. What can people do in our last few minutes? We talked a little bit about this, but I like to try to leave the audience with something that's, positive as far as, I know you talked about educating people and those kinds of things, but I'd love to say, what are the top few things that we can really do to make a difference in the quality of our own life? You had mentioned that we're kind of running out of time, or we've run out of time to make any huge infrastructure changes,
yeah.
But I would assume on a small scale, we might have a little bit of time to create something small for our own community or something where we can try to prepare a little bit.
Sure. The first thing is knowledge. Learning about the problem and facing any unpleasant reality is essential for real solutions to come forward. And we've been doing that at Culture Change for many years, and I would urge people to look at culturechange.org not only for the information that we're offering there, and going to the archive section, they can see the Fall of Petroleum Civilization section. It's important that people look at all the links and sources of information to decide for oneself. But taking action is vital. And so on the individual level, we need to look at how much petroleum we're using. What can we do about our energy habits? So if this is slashed and we learn how to live with less energy and we learn how to share appliances and cut back on disposable products and start to recognize that using plastic is just throwing petroleum away and causing a gigantic health crisis, then people can start to get together and make some plans. And whether it's an affinity group or a commune or a neighborhood association, people can start to cope with what the future is going to be offering in terms of hardship and chaos. So if there is any kind of community gardening possibly, or if people can grow food and share it, one person may be very good at growing potatoes. Someone else may be good at growing other kinds of vegetables. Some people will have physical strength essential for depaving. Other people are going to be important for child care, because if we're not going to drive our children halfway across town for some stranger to raise them in child care or in schools, there's going to be more neighborhood interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And why should the elders be put out to pasture when they can teach the grandkids what's important to know about living?
Mm-hmm.
And for example, my mother, who's 85, only discussed recently how a refrigerator was created by digging a giant hole in the kitchen on the farm in Idaho.
Hmm.
So we need to get together and learn from each other and support each other. That is what's not happening in our isolated consumer culture.
Right. Absolutely. Well, that sounds, I feel a little more positive. I just learned about a community-supported agriculture farm, and they actually don't use petroleum to run their farm. They actually use horses to till the field, and it just sounds like such an incredible way to support ourselves and support the farmers, and those are the types of things that look like they're going to be more and more important.
Yes, and those kinds of work are going to be more respected. Like in Cuba, people growing food are greatly respected. They had to go through their petrol collapse, and they've come out all right.
Hmm. Well, that's good to know as well. Jan, thank you so much for being with us. Jan Lumberg, why don't you give your website information again so people can contact you or learn more?
Sure. www.petrocollapse.org for the conference. And Culture Change is at www.culturechange.org.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Jan.
Thank you, Julie. It was a pleasure as always.
All right. Take care. Have
bye.
A good time in New York.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye. Well, this is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich. Again, I'm Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant, certainly understanding the importance of having healthy food grown locally by people that can help us sustain that type of growth and health in our community. So I'm really happy that we could have Jan on today to talk to us about his expertise and how all of these pieces are all really very related. So thank you for listening. You, again, are listening to KPOO San Francisco. My website is healthfullivingsf.com, healthfullivingsf as in San Francisco.com. Thank you, and stay tuned next week.